Today is Monday, April 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
This is one of our demands, you know. We are at the SBA and Declaration of Freedom and Change.
Also ahead, Sudanese protest organizers rallied their supporters to gather today outside of Army headquarters in Khartoum, the capital, and the White House considers sending migrants to sanctuary cities. It's all on today's International Edition. Sudanese protest organizers rallied their supporters to gather today outside of Army headquarters in Khartoum because the organizers said there was an attempt to break up the days-long sit-in demonstration there. In the span of 3 days, Sudan's military council saw a change in top leadership as well as the arrest of former government officials who served under the Bashir regime. Nuha Zien, a Texas-based spokesperson for the Sudanese Professionals Association, says the military council's move over the weekend to arrest former government officials is welcome, but they have a list of demands that has not yet been realized. Earlier today, she spoke with my colleague, Ayan Dien Borg.
This is one of our demands, you know. We are at the SBA and Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces. We gave already like 4 or 5 days ago a mandate to the Sudanese Armed Forces. And from that time, there was a recall from Abna Auf and for 30 hours, if you know, and then this new military council by General Burhan. And 2 days ago, the Declaration of Change and Freedom Forces, they sent a committee to meet him and provide, submit our demands. Our main demand is we want to transfer the power to civilian transitional government. And then to arrest all these old regime symbols, you know, from the president and his vice president and the old people in the past regime that were committed crimes and injustice action against Sudanese people.
Well, the military council also announced that they would remove protesters from the sit-in by force.
No, that cannot be done. You know, we are at this Change and Freedom Forces. We continue in our sitting. We have two parallel lines. We continue our protesting in the sitting, and even we have lots of programs and activities done there since April 6th. And at the same time with this line, we have a parallel line, which is continuing our general and political work or line with the military council to achieve our demands.
And now, what is left for the Sudanese Professionals Association? I've spoken to a number of people who say there's still a lot of work ahead.
Our goals and demands are very clear, you know, from the beginning, to bring this regime down. So stepping or resigning al-Bashir or two or three of his colleagues, this is not our entire demand. So our entire demand should be achieved, you know, by bringing down the whole regime. Not only two or three members, including al-Bashir of them. And the second demand that was not achieved till now, and that's why it is left, that to transfer or to hand over the power to a transitional civilian government, not by military council, like what's happening for the last 48 hours. So we gave a mandate to the Sudanese armed forces to take the power from al-Bashir regime and to hand over this power to a transitional civilian government that will take this power for 4 years and then to be like elective government by the end of the 4 years. This was the plan. But now the military council is not the plan to continue for 1 year.
That was Nuha Zien, a Texas-based spokesperson for the Sudanese Professionals Association, speaking to Ayan Dien Borg from Houston. Well, officials in eastern Afghanistan say a gunman opened fire at a wedding, killing 5 people and wounding 15 before he fled the scene. Authorities say they are not aware of a motive for the attack yesterday in Khost Province. The Taliban and other militant groups are active in the area that borders Pakistan, but shooting attacks on weddings are rare. The area, however, is rife with tribal rivalries, officials say. Also yesterday, at least 7 children were killed killed and 10 others wounded when an unexploded mortar shell detonated in the eastern province of Lagman. Officials said the victims were playing with the explosive near the provincial capital of Metalam. A provincial government spokesman said an investigation was underway to determine how the children found the mortar and why it exploded. He said all the victims were under 15. Well, the White House yesterday, echoing President Donald Trump, said sending undocumented migrants to sanctuary U.S. cities that have protected migrants from deportation remains a possibility, even though government agencies have said it would be impractical and there is no money allocated to do it. Trump said late Saturday in a Twitter, Democrats must change the immigration laws fast. If not, sanctuary cities must immediately act to take care of the illegal immigrants. And this includes gang members, drug dealers, human traffickers, and criminals of all shapes, sizes, and kinds. Change the laws now, he tweeted. Well, in the studio is VOA's Ken Bredemeyer. He has been covering this story for us. And Ken, thank you so much for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Well, Ken, first of all, let's talk about just the sanctuary cities. What are some of them, and really, what can they offer undocumented migrants?
There's about several hundred sanctuary cities throughout the country, and the whole state of California, which is the U.S.'s biggest state by population, and a lot of officials in these communities, oftentimes supported by churches and other humanitarian groups, look to protect undocumented immigrants from being deported. These jurisdictions have pointedly refused, much to the dismay of the Trump administration, to cooperate with federal officials to remove undocumented immigrants and deport them back to their home countries, often Central American countries, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. So these jurisdictions are looking to the U.S. government as being inhumane in the way they're treating these people who are often escaping poverty and violence in their home countries.
So then why are some of them opposing President Trump's idea of sending them, the undocumented migrants, there now?
Not all of these jurisdictions have said they're opposing it, but some are, for the simple reason that they're disputing Trump's version of this whole affair, that it would be punishment if they were sent to these jurisdictions. In fact, U.S. government statistics show that Native Americans commit more crimes than undocumented immigrants. So they're saying that the premise of what Trump is trying to do here is a political stance, trying to overrun these communities with too many people who might need local government services.
So in punishment, is it, you're meaning punishment for the cities?
That's what Trump seems to view. Sending undocumented immigrants, those are migrants who have no official U.S. Citizenship papers or right to be in the country. But U.S. law gives them a chance to win asylum. If they set one foot on U.S. land, they can apply for asylum, and that is, in fact, what all of them often do.
And what have you found in terms of what's going on at the border? Is there a crisis there?
Well, certainly there are many tens of thousands of people. It was over 100,000 people crossed into the U.S. and were detained by U.S. authorities in March alone. That's about twice the number of March 2018. So certainly the Trump administration and even the Homeland Security chief from the Obama administration, Jay Johnson, said there indeed is a crisis at the border. There's not enough beds that the U.S. has to house these people, and they are being released into the U.S. They can go to family members who might already be in the U.S. To find their way to other cities, mostly unfettered, just on the promise that they'll show up sometime in a distant future, a year or two, for an asylum hearing. Some do, some don't.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for the insight into this situation. That's VOA's Ken Breitemeyer. He's in the studio here with me today. Well, U.S. President Donald Trump took a new swipe today at Representative Ilhan Omar for her comments about the 9/11 terrorist attacks, along with the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for defending the Somali-American lawmaker. Associated Press reporter Sagar Magani has more.
Freshman Democrat Ilhan Omar says the president's endangering lives, including hers, after he retweeted a video purportedly showing her dismissing the 9/11 attacks. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she's talked to Capitol Police about keeping Omar safe while demanding the president take down the video. This morning, he tweets Pelosi's lost all control of Congress, and before she defends Omar, should look at the Congresswoman's history of what he calls anti-Semitic and anti-Israel statements. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Among the top stories in the world, an independent monitoring group in Pakistan expresses concern about the state of human rights in the country and calls for the immediate remedy of the issues highlighted in its annual report released today. American and Taliban officials indicate their months-long peace dialogue remains on track despite the intensification of hostilities in Afghanistan that came with the start of the insurgent group's spring offensive. And the number of measles cases worldwide nearly quadrupled in the first 3 months of the year compared to last year, the World Health Organization reports today. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomical history was made on April 10th when it was announced that scientists with the Event Horizon Telescope project had, for the first time, directly observed and captured an image of a black hole. Now, the black hole, which lies in the center of the Messier 87 galaxy, some 55 million light-years away, has a name. It's Povehi. It's a Hawaiian language name that means embellished dark source of unending creation. Two of the telescopes that make up the Event Horizon Telescope are located atop Mauna Kea on Hawaii Island. The astronomers collaborated with Larry Kimura, a Hawaiian language professor and cultural practitioner at the University of Hawaii at Hilo, to select the name. Povehi was taken from the Kamulipo, an ancient chant that describes the creation of the Hawaiian universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Well, Ivanka Trump, who serves as advisor to her father, President Donald Trump, is on a trip to Africa aimed at bringing attention to women's economic issues. Yesterday, Trump visited a coffee shop and a cloth factory in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. There, she announced a $50 million development program. The Women's Global Development and Prosperity Initiative is a Trump administration effort to increase women's economic participation in developing countries around the world. The goal is to coordinate efforts of government agencies, public and private groups to develop women's entrepreneurship. Trump spoke about the program and barriers women face in running their own businesses.
Women have disproportionately high barriers to thriving both in the workplace and as entrepreneurs. And as Mark alluded to, that's why we launched the first ever all of U.S. government initiative called WGDP, which seeks to accomplish three goals. The first pillar is allowing women to prosper in the workplace, and that's technical assistance, mentorship, vocational education. The second is promoting women entrepreneurs like yourself, and that pillar is very much exemplified by the announcement we'll be making in just a moment. And the third pillar is about changing laws that prohibit women's full and free participation in their local economies. Not only the laws, but also once the laws have been changed, making sure that they're implemented countrywide, not just in the cities.
Trump was also to meet with Ethiopian President Saleh Wergzada and Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed before traveling to Ivory Coast as part of a four-day Africa trip. Well, the Australian government says Queensland-born Julian Assange will get no special treatment after his arrest in London. Lawyers for the WikiLeaks co-founder are, however, urging Canberra to intervene to stop his extradition to the United States. Assange, who had been living in Ecuador's London embassy for 7 years, was arrested last Thursday. He could also face a renewed investigation into an allegation of rape in Sweden. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The United States wants to extradite Julian Assange from Britain because of his alleged role in one of the largest ever leaks of government secrets in 2010. Australian-born Assange faces a charge of conspiracy to commit computer intrusion in the US. He could be jailed for up to 5 years, but it's possible that further charges could be added later by prosecutors. Swedish justice officials also say they're re-examining a suspected rape at the request of the alleged victim's lawyer. Assange had sought refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden over the allegations of sexual assault. But Ecuador abruptly withdrew its asylum and allowed UK police to arrest the WikiLeaks co-founder. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison says Assange, who was born in the Queensland city of Townsville, will get no special treatment.
We support Australians in those cases by providing that consular assistance. So Mr. Assange will get the same support that any other Australian would in these circumstances. He's not going to be given any special treatment. He'll get the same treatment as everybody else. He'll get the same support as everyone else.
Campaigners in Australia consider Assange's arrest and possible extradition to Sweden or the US as a threat to investigative journalism. Greg Barnes, Assange's Australian lawyer, is urging Canberra to do more to protect him.
The United States is seeking to extradite a person who has simply expressed themselves, if one can put it that way, in accordance with a core liberal value, which of course is freedom of speech. And Australian journalists and Australians generally, I think, should be very, very concerned about the chilling impact of this precedent. And the Australian government, therefore, and Australian politicians ought to be concerned about it.
Any request by the United States to extradite Assange must be processed through the UK court system. The Australian is due to face a hearing over his possible extradition to the US in early May. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Hello, this is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa Show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Voices. We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about.
Sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick.
And Hadiza Kiari.
And Ayan Bior.
And Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
The operator of Japan's nuclear power plant at Fukushima began removing fuel from one of three damaged reactors today. The Tokyo Electric Power Company said its workers started removing nuclear fuel rods from part of Reactor 3. The operation is more than 4 years behind schedule, and equipment problems temporarily delayed work today. TEPCO has estimated it will take 2 years to remove 566 nuclear fuel rods from the disabled reactor. The work is being carried out remotely from a control room near the reactor because radiation levels remain very high at the site. After cleanup operations are complete for Reactor 3, TEPCO will continue to work to remove 1,000 nuclear fuel rods that are in two other reactors at the nuclear power center. The three reactors were severely damaged in the earthquake and resulting tsunami that struck Fukushima on March 11, 2011. The twin disasters took an estimated 18,000 lives. Well, more than 30 journalists and publishers are due to face court today over their coverage of Cardinal George Pell's trial for child sex abuse. Prosecutors are seeking fines and jail terms over accusations that news outlets breached strict suppression orders in the case. Experts say the reporting ban raises issues about the freedom of the press. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Cardinal George Pell, who was a key advisor to Pope Francis in the Vatican, was to have faced two separate child sex abuse trials. A judge said details of the first case had to remain secret because of fears that media coverage would influence the jury in the second trial. A sweeping suppression order, common in parts of Australia, was imposed. When a verdict in the initial trial was delivered last December, it was covered by international news websites, including the Washington Post. Several Australian agencies are accused of breaching the ban by reporting cryptically that an unnamed high-profile person had been found guilty of a serious crime that couldn't be made public. Experts say Australian reporting restrictions were futile in the global digital age. Associate Professor Jason Bosland is from Melbourne University Law School.
An outlet, for example, like the Washington Post, I mean, they can be sent, you know, as many notices as the prosecution likes, but they're outside the jurisdiction and they're in a jurisdiction where the right to report the courts is protected by the First Amendment. Under the First Amendment, a suppression order would be seen as completely repugnant to the freedom of the press.
Some of Australia's biggest media companies are among those facing contempt allegations. They include Nine Entertainment Company, The Age, The Australian Financial Review, Macquarie Media, and several News Corp publications. Most intend to vigorously fight the charges. Cardinal Pell was jailed in March for 6 years after being convicted of sexually abusing two boys. The former Vatican treasurer is the most senior Catholic figure ever to be found guilty of sexual offences against children. Pell abused the 13-year-old choir boys in a Melbourne cathedral in 1996. He is appealing against his conviction. The second trial was subsequently abandoned by prosecutors. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Well, Tiger Woods, one of the world's best golfers, captured his fifth Masters Championship yesterday, his 15th major professional victory after an 11-year drought from winning the sport's biggest tournaments. Woods, with a big smile on his face, thrust both arms into the air as he holed his final putt on the 18th green for a bogey. He hugged his mother, his two children, daughter Sam and son Charlie, and other well-wishers as he headed to the clubhouse to sign his scorecard.
If you look at it, my first 14 wins in majors were I had the lead in every one of them, or tied for the lead. To have the opportunity to come back like this, it is probably one of the biggest wins I've ever had, for sure.
At 43, Woods is the oldest Masters champion since Jack Nicklaus, who won the 1986 Masters at 46. The 79-year-old Nicklaus holds the record for most major golf championships with 18, with Woods now trailing the mark by 3. You've been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program, Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice